English Language Teaching Under the Cover.
Hello and welcome to ELT Under the Covers Teaching Methodology Series. In this episode, we're doing a deep dive into Community Language Learning, CLL. Let's check it out. Community Language Learning, otherwise known as CLL, is a teaching methodology developed in the 1970s by a priest, stroke psychologist, stroke educator, Charles Curran. Drawing on principles of counseling therapy espoused by Carl Rogers in his person-centered therapy, CLL emphasizes the importance of the learners themselves and lets them design the lesson content, which means that CLL has no predetermined lesson objectives at all. The teacher plays a supporting role as a counselor, while the learners are just encouraged to work together, interacting and helping each other in a supportive community. Because of its counseling links, it's often described as counseling learning. In its pure form, how it works is: one, the learners sit in a circle with an audio recorder in the center and the teacher stroke counselor stays on the outside of the circle. Two, learners start a conversation in their native language and it's recorded for later use. Three, the counselor stroke teacher provides translations and explanations to support the learners. Four, learners repeat this new language as accurately as they can. And five, there's further reflection and analysis of the new language. The recorded dialogue is often transcribed and put on the board by the teacher. Community language learning. We're going to do a deep dive, but first, introductions. I'm Neil of Team Teacher.
Hello, everybody. It's Professor Rich.
I think a lot of people think about community language learning and think that it's very similar, or the most similar of the three methods to communicative language teaching that we do today, where the focus is on this kind of fluency-based authentic interaction between students, and the teacher becomes more of a facilitator. And I very much think that community language learning is where this ideas come from about student-centric teaching, or student-centric language learning, where the teacher is in the is kind of in the background and the students are doing stuff and the teacher is a facilitator, and then we get these criticisms of teachers who are too teacher-centric and all that stuff, right? And from that comes teacher talking time and all the rest of it. One of the things, sorry, go on.
I was just going to add on to that, and I think one of the things that I noticed when I was kind of doing research and reading up about this, I do have somewhat of a background with counselling. I was studying to be a counsellor at one point in my life, specifically the humanistic approach, which was Carl Rogers. So I was pleasantly surprised when I was like, oh, this is kind of based around that. And this idea of student-centred approach, I like the community language learning because it seemed to be that you're just treating the person as a whole. As a whole person. They call it whole person therapy, in that you're meeting this whole person. You're not just dictating the language to them. You're kind of building a relationship with them and going, well, where do you want to kind of go with this? What do you want to say? And I'm going to help you say that. Help you express that. I see a lot of counselling in there, and I am not surprised at all when it's talked about as in counselling learning. And a lot of counselling is learning in a way, because you're learning about yourself. So it's interesting here that we've got something that's extrinsic that they're learning, but they're learning it through themselves. It's almost kind of like you're being that parent, and you know that the kid needs to learn to speak English, or they need to learn math, or they need to learn to just not you know, control their emotions even, and you're just kind of guiding them along and nudging them perhaps in a way that you think will help them or not help them, give them the space, the opportunity to experience something that will enable growth, I feel. It's a difficult, I find it difficult to put in words, but...
Well, that's what facilitation is supposed to be, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what teacher as facilitator is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Now, that element of it, I think, yeah, you can get really deep with it. And probably in some ways, you know a lot more about this with your counselling and your experience as a parent and your experiments with that in terms of how you're kind of, you know... encouraging your son to learn without just giving him the answer and stuff. I mean, all mm-hmm. teachers should do that a little bit, but here it's even more hands-off. Mm-hmm. I think one of the questions that popped into my head, this is kind of changing the subject a little bit, is it's about, and we've talked about this before, at some point they talk about how the teacher kind of feeds in language.
Mm.
Now, I know how I would do that, but I know some other people who don't like the idea of the teacher interrupting the authenticity of communication mm-hmm. as well, is another thing that people might say about it. So what do we know about that, about the kind of pure community language learning? How does this feeding in happen?
Well, in the purest form, it should be the students basically decide, they go start a conversation in their native language, and then the teacher would do the translation, and then we would kind of like feed that back to them in English, and you know, they would practice it that way. So it's derived from authentic student interaction. But there, you could see obvious holes in that, especially if you've got, you know, like some of the clips that I showed there was pairs, people in pairs. So what if people talk about things different and, you know, they've got on different topics? So I think there kind of has to be, in a pragmatic world, a balance. So maybe they just, you know, for your first class, you do introductions. But, you know, like maybe later on, you kind of all have to agree on a theme that they want to talk about today. But I think that's generally done in conjunction with students and teachers. So, you know, the teacher doesn't just go, okay, now today we're going to talk about calling customer service or something like that. That it would be something like, well, what do you want to talk about today? And someone might say, I want to talk about going to the zoo. And another person might say, well, I really want to talk about buying hardware at Home Depot. And then they go, well, no, we don't want to do either of those. And they all come to an agreement as a community. That what makes sense to me. We do have an example of community language learning. We don't, it's very difficult to find them on the old Tinternet, but this one was one of the better ones, and this one is actually, they're learning Spanish, so I think we could kind of get a better idea of how it works, because, you know, we're native English speakers, and we kind of have a little bit of a background in Spanish.
Good morning. How are you guys doing today?
Pretty good.
Doing really good. Today we're going to be going over how to form polite requests in Spanish. Fine, close the door. Yeah. All right, I should say, could you please close the door? Podría cerrar la puerta, por favor.
Ah.
Okay. So thank you very much. I just asked you to close the door for me. And how did you feel the first time when I asked you?
I liked it better the second time.
Yeah, the first time was a little bit rude, wasn't it? Well, there's also polite and impolite ways to say things in Spanish as well. And today we're going to get a grasp of
Me pone una cerveza ahora.
I feel like we're going to see some differences between Latin American Spanish and continental European Spanish.
How are you guys feeling today in general? Are you guys doing good? Tired? Okay. All right. All right. Nobody overly stressed out today.
Kind of awkward, but
we've seen that before, haven't we? That sort of nobody overly stressed out thing. We've seen it in a few other things that we've watched. I don't know if I've ever said something like that to my students, but I just think it's a completely useless thing to say.
It is. I mean, because what are you going to do? How are you going to resolve that? You're gonna say, yeah, I'm particularly stressed today. You know, my cat shaved off all its fur. what are they going to do? Does she have a bag of edibles or something like that? She's gonna, here, take one of these. I've got here.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? If she's offering something, that's one thing, but then just offer it. You know, like if you look at a student and they seem stressed out, just be like, all right, it's not an exam. It's okay. It's just, we're just having a conversation. Mistakes are fine. Mistakes are okay. Everybody makes mistakes. You know, sometimes maybe they just need some reassurance or they need to understand something. Well, like if you're teaching Japanese students, you really do need to emphasize the fact that everything they say doesn't have to be perfectly correct, and in fact there's no such thing as perfectly correct when it comes to language.
That's perfect, Rich. And you know, that's I was gonna say something similar, in that, you know, if they are stressed out, the only thing that you can really do, especially when you think of it from a counseling perspective, is to just acknowledge and accept the emotion. You're stressed, that's okay. It's okay to be stressed. It's a stressful environment. This is what, and then what you do is you say, this is what's going to happen next. And you give assurance that, you know, like you try to allay fears and give assurance that, oh yeah, it's not going to be, you know, so bad or whatever. That's a terrible way of putting it. And then let them in on the plan. You know, this is what we're going to do. This is step by step. So often anxiety comes from fear in the future of the unknown. So, you know, kind of letting them in on what you're going to do, how the process works, helps that subside. But you literally cannot control other people's emotions.
I tell you what, though. Well, I mean, your message was not just about controlling other people's emotions, but it was about people accepting their own emotions, right?
Yeah, that's the two parts, is having people acknowledge that, everyone acknowledge that stress is stress. Don't accept that you're stressed per se, in that, you know, like I have to accept that I'm stressed. But you just accept that it is what it is. You know what I mean? It is there. Acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And you know, we will work around it. We'll deal with it. But here's what's going to happen. So, you know, maybe you've got a better understanding going forward.
Sometimes I feel like we don't have enough words and language to correctly talk about this kind of stuff. And also, it's overly complicated by the fact that a lot of things are subjective. What is stress? How do you measure it? And all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Because one of the conversations I've been having recently with students, I do a lot of presentation coaching, and a lot of people subscribe to the purveying advice to be confident. And I would actually say that really a lot of people, including people who give presentations, they say that that's the advice, be confident, you know. And I've always taken the perspective of, embrace your nervousness. If you are nervous and you have to give a presentation, you know, just embrace it as much as you can, because actually the most excited you will ever be giving a presentation is doing one when you're nervous and then it goes well. Right. So it was like when I did my first live stream, I was nervous about it and it went well and it was amazing. I felt great. Right. Now I do them and I don't feel nervous, and neither do I get incredibly excited about it, you know? So I think there's something to be said for embracing that nervousness, because I think it can add a certain kind of special energy to things. But a lot of people then seem to think that that means like, oh, be nervous, but it's not be nervous. It doesn't mean go on stage and whatever. And they probably have images in their head of people who've given terrible presentations because they were nervous, which, you know, that's true. That can happen. But also, like you're saying, I think there has to be an acceptance of it. You can't just be confident. What does that mean? Well, you can try and fake it a bit.
There's a, you can't. I think the way I see it, there's a good book on this. The title is actually basically the nugget of gold. It's by Susan Jeffers. It's called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And that's basically what it is. It's accept your stress, accept you're nervous, and just do it. It's not right. It doesn't change anything. Yeah. You know, if it goes bad, it goes bad. If it goes good, it goes good. You still do it though.
Yeah.
And do it to the best as you can, but you know, don't, you know, try to hide or, you know, like remove any other emotion. You can't. It is what it is. So you just kind of go through the process.
Yeah, that's my perspective.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know where she was going with that. I think maybe she's just kind of the niceties, but maybe she's building into that. Because I did actually quite enjoy the transition that she did there of like, close the door. Oh, sorry. Please close the door. I thought that was a very easy way to contextualize what she was going to talk about. But I don't know if you noticed, she did introduce the teaching point. It was not derived from the students.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, I was actually going through my head. Well, maybe this is a slightly more modern take on CLL, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's have a look.
Your day is about to get better because I have here, in honor of Hillary's birthday, we have this delicious cake.
Always great to bribe students.
You guys all want a piece. But in order to get the cake, you're going to either have to have it offered to you or ask for it politely, okay? And we're going to have to, or then somebody want to cut the cake before we get started? Okay, let's have Hillary do it in honor of her mom's birthday. All right. So, like I said, you're going to have to either ask or be offered a piece of cake. Yes, you do, but don't worry. I know you guys don't have that experience yet. It's our third day of our first semester of Spanish. So what I'm going to actually do is you guys are going to be having a conversation with each other, all right? And you're going to be speaking in Spanish, but I am going to work as your human translator. I'm going to be standing outside the circle, and when you guys want to say for something to ask or to offer, you're going to raise your hand or motion to me. You're going to tell me in English what you would like to say. Then I'm going to translate it for you in Spanish. All right? And what we're going to do is, while we're doing that also, is I have this recording device. And so after you first said what you want to say in English, I am going to translate it for you, full sentence in Spanish. And then so you can hear it. And then I'm going to break it apart bit by bit. I'm going to say a bit of it. And you're gonna repeat after me. And when I feel that you've done well with it, feel comfortable with it, I'm gonna hold up this recording device, and then I'm going to record it for you. And then it's gonna sound choppy probably at first, you would think, but then in the end, we're going to replay it, and the whole conversation's gonna sound smooth. And you guys are gonna hear each other speaking in Spanish. All right. All right. So why don't you get started here, Hillary? Alright, thanks for saying it nice and polite there. Say, ¿podría tener un pedazo de pastel? ¿Podría tener?
¿Podría tener? ¿Podría tener?
Un pedazo de pastel.
Un pedazo de pastel.
Un pedazo de pastel.
Un pedazo de pastel. Un pedazo.
Dialogue written on the board.
written on the board. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the sentences phrase by phrase, and we're going to figure out what the translation is, all right? Do you remember? ¿Podría tener un pedazo de pastel? How about podría tener? Do you remember what you asked in English, Gordy? Yep, it's very close. Can I have? And to make it very polite, we said, could I have? And so I'm going to put here the English underneath. Could I have? All right. Yeah, got un pedazo. And then that's right, you said a big piece. So I'm going to add in the word grande. I just had a piece of cake, but it was a big piece. So I added the word grande. So what would un pedazo grande? What would that mean, class?
A big piece.
A big piece. All right, then de pastel. Yep, there we go. We're talking about cake. And then you guys probably have heard this one other than this class before. Por favor? Please, that's right. Good job, guys. All right, what's another one I got? All right. So we have si, te daré un pedazo de pastel. How about si, te daré? Remember what you said? Yes, I'll give you a big yes. Yep. So we have yes. I will give. Yes. I will give. And then you said, I will give you, right? So we want to go, I will give you. And then you guys know this one, right? Un pedazo de pastel. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. How about te gustaría? You were it was asking a question.
Both that the gustaría and podría kind of what I made.
That's a good observation. A really good observation. They're both the ia is making it a polite request form, just like conjugating the verb. So te gustaría. Do any of you remember what she was asking?
That piece of cake in there.
Yeah, un pedazo de pastel grande también.
I think I asked my if she would like.
Yeah. So what would te gustaría be?
So would you like a piece of cake?
Yep. I'm just gonna put would you. Like, and then I'm gonna put just dot dot dot. We already know how to do what's that word at the end?
Yeah,
oh, that's right, también. Glad you noticed that one, Hillary. What do you guys think también would mean? Knowing that she already asked somebody else already has a piece of cake, so now she's asking if someone would like one. Yep, two or as well. Two as well. Also, that also is a good translation for it. Let's put also. Good thought, Brady. All right. And then in response, sí, me gustaría.
Yes, I would.
Yep, you got the point. And so you guys probably also recognize me, which is similar to me or I. It's a good one to point out. I'm just going to put yes, I would. And then we have this one we'll probably recognize. ¿Te gustaría un pedazo también?
Would you like maybe?
Yep, because we got pastel. Yeah. And so you figured out that pedazo is piece. So would you like a piece also? And then sí, gracias. That was? Yes, thank you. There we go. All right. So good job with that, guys. I'm going to read the entire dialogue to you, or I should say conversation in Spanish real quick. I'm going to do it twice. I want you first to just listen to me saying it. Next, I want you to close your eyes while I'm saying it. But first, keep your eyes open, reading it as I say it. ¿Podrías tener un pedazo de pastel, por favor? Sí, te daré un pedazo de pastel. ¿Te gustaría un pedazo de pastel grande también? Sí, me gustaría. ¿Te gustaría un pedazo también? Sí, gracias. All right, I'm going to read it one more time. This time I want you guys to close your eyes and think about the conversation. Think about who was saying what as we did it. ¿Podría tener un pedazo de pastel, por favor? Sí, te daré un pedazo de pastel. ¿Te gustaría un pedazo de pastel grande también? Sí, me gustaría. ¿Te gustaría un pedazo también? Sí, gracias. All right, guys, so for our last activity, I'm going to have you do is I'm going to play the role of a human computer. All right? So you guys, there's a couple words I know you have a little trouble pronouncing. I want you guys to point to a word up on in Spanish, and then you're going to have, I'm going to say it for you, and then you repeat after me. And you can do that as many times until you feel comfortable with the pronunciation. All right? So go right at it. I'll wait till you guys are ready. So this one here.
You know, it was top heavy at the beginning and kind of clunky, a little bit awkward, and I think it was just because she was introducing the whole concept. But I feel like if this was just used every time, she wouldn't have to keep explaining. You know, it would have been a little bit more streamlined. I'm not sure how... I like the realia. I'm not sure how affordable that would be, or... Generally, in a language-speaking class, I found it not great to have students with things in their mouth while they're also trying to speak. But it kind of lends it to that because they were able to have the cake and like listen to the recordings as they ate the cake. And I thought, oh, okay, okay. But I did like it. I liked that it were... The back end where the students were being mined for that material. Everything was authentic. They produced it. She translated it, and then they kind of just reviewed and went over it. I did like the whole practice, close your eyes, practice, try to remember back to the conversation that you were having when she's, you know, reading out the text and stuff, because I feel like it just keeps tying it back to them. It's like stitching it to previous memories. And I feel like that's kind of like that, what is it, like the web of learning or whatever it is, where you're constantly, if you've learned something new, you want to tie it to something that you already knew. Or, you know, if you've got, you want to start a new habit, then add it on to an old habit. And it builds in that way. I very much liked that approach. And you could see the students towards the end, they were getting pretty engaged. You know, that guy made a good observation about the R, and then he shared that with the class, and she was like, yeah, it's a good observation. Everyone else comes like, yeah, okay. And you could see that they were thinking about it. And, you know, I could see a lot of positives with that. I could also see a lot of disadvantages or negatives, especially the translation. You'd have to be really strong with your second language to be able to do that.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll pick it up there. Uh-huh. So translation, I don't know if that's how they speak Latin American Spanish. Maybe they do, but I've never heard a Valencian say podría tener. In fact, I used to say it when I first went over there.
And they said,
I used to go
that.
To the supermarket. Well, they always looked at me funny, and then I asked someone and they said, oh, no one would ever say that. That's like saying, may I have permission, you know, to have two bags. It's like you're asking for...
My understanding was asking kind of like a philosophical question. Like, is it possible in this universe to have a bag?
So that's also it could either be that, or it could be, you know, a sort of a permission thing. But it should be a polite request, which in Spanish is ¿Me das dos bolsas, por favor? And I'm not sure what you were saying for cake, like un pectado or something.
Pastel.
De pastel. Yeah. But she said like un pedazo de pastel. Right. I think in Spain they sent to say trozo, I think. Un trozo. But that could easily just be a difference. So that was a bit odd. So then that leads into your thing, like, I mean, her Spanish seemed pretty good. Mm. So maybe it's just, you know, Spanish has a wider variety than English, we might say. Mm. English is more standardized. Spanish has different varieties, which are very different. Did you know in Costa Rican Spanish, that's the correct one, they don't roll their R's at the end.
Blasphemy.
So in the middle. So they don't say pero, they say perro. Really, they say perro. Like, I couldn't believe it. I've got a Costa Rican student, and she was like, no, we say perro, perro. And I'm like, what? that sounds like me when I got off the plane in Spain in 2008. So that was kind of funny. But anyway, okay, so moving on. Translation, you're right. That is a limitation. First of all, this is not at all what I thought community language learning was, actually. So I wonder how perfect an example this is, because as you said, it's very difficult to come up with to find the examples of CLL in practice.
Yeah.
So I don't know for certain if this is a paradigmatic example or not, but anyway, it's not what I expected. Mm-hmm. So just very, very, some like outline of it, but the general concept of what I expect. In fact, that kind of clip we saw in the intro of like the, you know, sort of the East Asian teacher and the students, was it Thailand or something? Maybe. Indonesia?
Yeah.
Whatever it was, like that looked a bit more like it to me. So anyway, okay. So at the start, I didn't really like her instructions. Now that's me as an English teacher who teaches people who can't speak English. So obviously my instructions are going to be pretty different to that, because she was saying, okay, first of all, what we're going to do is we're going to do this, and then we're going to do that, and then you're going to ask me this question, and blah, 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 you know. And I was just thinking, like, oh god, I would never like explain something like that, you know. As an English language teacher, we kind of learn to say like, okay, so first you'll have a conversation, and I'll start, you know, but okay, maybe she doesn't need to do that because they're
native English speakers. The graded instructions. Yeah, I think what it is with those instructions and why she went into so much depth was with CLL, there's that idea of the Krashen's monitor theory, the effective filter hypothesis. So the idea being is if you let people in on the process and go through it step by step, it allows them to relax because they're not having to think about what's coming next because they know they it's pulling back the curtain so they could go, oh, okay, so this is what to expect. And in psychology, the idea is if you know what to expect, you feel more relaxed.
I like that part of it.
Yeah.
I like that part of it. That's what I would call signposting to some extent.
Yeah.
I like that part of it. It's just that I found her explanation a little bit verbose.
Yeah.
Which, but okay. And maybe I'm being overly critical there. She didn't do any ICQs, but all right. Whatever. But being this not
but they're native.
People
realized as soon as I said it, I was like, yeah, the native speak. I do it with my kid all the time.
I don't know if you realize that, you know, but for me, being a community language teacher, I kind of go around now and I see natives communicating with each other sometimes, giving instructions, and I'm like, ooh, you're opening up a can of worms there that someone could easily misunderstand that and this could happen. And, you know, you start to actually realize that, you know, we do actually learn skills being teachers, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of soft skills.
One of them is giving concise instructions. So, okay, moving on from that because it's kind of overly critical really anyway. So then you were talking about one of the positives and you were talking about like working with this conversation and closing their eyes and imagining it and all this kind of stuff. So for me, this is a type of activity that in my head I call conversation patterns. I don't know what, I don't know what it's actually called. That might be what it's actually called. I really got to grips with this in Japan because the place where I taught in Japan, they didn't have any resources. They just have a whiteboard and they have lesson plans and that's it. There's no printouts or whatever. So they really liked working with these conversation patterns in Japan. And I really like conversation patterns, actually. I think they can be very powerful, especially for this kind of pair work. And they're actually surprisingly adaptable. Because your initial thought with a conversation pattern is, oh, I'm just learning this whole conversation word for word. But what you start to learn is how to take bits out and put other bits in, you know? So maybe we started off with, could I have a piece of cake? And then it changes into, you know, could I have a pen, please? Oh, I'm sorry, I've only got a piece of it. Whatever, you know, it starts to become much more flexible and it can lead into freer speaking, actually. And that's I have this in my head and I'd love to do this more, actually, but I don't at the moment. I'm not currently teaching groups, but one of the final classes I taught in Vietnam was about language for agreeing and disagreeing. I had this conversation pattern about... you know, it just starts off with like expressing your opinion in a kind of an outrageous way. It's like, you know what? I think, and then there was like a list of like radical things that you could kind of say that you think. Like one of them was, I think Donald Trump is Batman. What do you reckon to that? You know, and the other person has to stay there. I'm sorry, I don't agree with that whatsoever. Right. And it was, I don't agree with that whatsoever because, and then they had to give their own free reason. And then the other person, the remainder of the conversation pattern just said, disagree, reason. And you just kept going then until you got to, you know, all right, I don't know what else to say. You win kind of thing. So, and it was every time the idea was to use like a different chunk of language for disagreeing, you know? And these were all language chunks that we practiced. But the top part was like more of a solid conversation pattern. I can't actually remember how it went, but there was a conversation pattern in there. And I do think they're good to work with because you get revision of the same language and you get that sort of phrasal pronunciation that's often missing in things. That's one of the things that I really liked about this, how everything was phrasal. And she really focused that as well. When she was translating, "de gustaría," she was saying like, oh, that means, would you like? you know, would you like dot, dot, dot? That kind of stuff was great, because anything that gets people away from this word to word type of thinking and translation that people kind of naturally fall into. I myself fell into it. I think pretty much anyone falls into it without realizing that it's a terrible way to learn language is word for word.
Yeah.
And languages don't even work like that. Our brain certainly doesn't work like that. So that part of it I really liked. Conversation patterns I really liked. There's so many things you can do with them. Like you say, closing your eyes and imagining what it was and trying to run through it again. What does it mean? And working with the translation in that way is also very possible. So that's the thing I loved. Actually, before I move on to my next point, what do you have any other things you want to talk about with conversation patterns?
No, I just want to reiterate with the closing your eyes and listening to the conversation and trying to imagine the conversation. It was, I really liked it mostly because it was tied to something that had already happened that they had produced. So they had a memory. It was tied back to that memory. That was the most important point for me. Not that it was a conversation pattern. It was the fact that it was a conversation pattern that they produced, that they have a memory for, that was being reinforced and built upon. So it's foundational learning. You know, you keep building upon the same thing again and again and again. And the more you tie it back to memories or things that you've encountered previously, the deeper the groove becomes.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's personalization, isn't it? And I think, most of the time when I would do conversation patterns, there'd be some sort of comprehension-based activity that would lead into some sort of vocabulary work, and then the conversation pattern emerges from that. Mm-hmm. Now, this is really interesting because this is one of the things about CLL, that what it is they produce it in their own native tongue, and then that's where the conversation pattern comes from. Like you say, that they can then link it back to an authentic experience. So that's kind of good.
But now, also, you know, like the opposite side would be, instead of them listening to that conversation that they've done and try to imagine or recollect or bring back that memory, the opposite way would be, sometimes I see, is that the teacher would create a new conversation pattern, and they would say, okay, now close your eyes and imagine this new conversation. And that's the difference. That new conversation, I don't think, is as good, because then that's two things that they have to do. They have to imagine this new scenario. They have to engage with this new conversation pattern, even if it's, you know, a little bit different. You know, they've mixed out a couple of words. It's not theirs as well. So that's why I keep reinforcing that it's going back. In comedy, it's like a callback humor. You know, you make that joke early at the start of the set, and then you weave it back into a new joke that you've made, and it ties it together, and it makes a bigger impact. Mm. I know I'm harping on about that, but yeah, please let's move on.
That's a good point. So the next thing I wanted to say is, I think that it took quite a long time to get to the punchline there, and I would expect. I felt. It's kind of funny because, you know, I often sort of defend teachers against TTT. But in this case, I think TTT was the thing on my... I even hate the expression TTT, but I think the teacher talk was... while I die. It's because I'm drinking Coke and it gives me phlegm. Anyway. In this case, I think there's a point to be made that she was talking a lot and the students didn't. And all we got was at the end a little bit of text, which is like, yo, now the students do loads of talking, dog. And it's like, well, maybe. I mean, we see that. Yeah, we see that a lot, don't we, on these videos? And you kind of say, well, do they? Maybe. I would like to see it, because I'd like to see whether they actually can have the conversation without looking up at the pattern, because that's the other thing with conversation patterns. What you do is you cover them more and more as you go through. So what I used to do is I'd have the board rubber, and as people were role playing through the conversations, I'd start rubbing out words, right? And then when I used this later, the British Council, and we got the interactive whiteboards, then you can do fancier stuff with it, where it kind of slowly disappears and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But that's the idea, isn't it? That you can start, you start to walk without the crutches.
Yeah, and I would love to see how she kind of monitors it, if she gives corrections, if she makes notes on corrections, if she records them when they do these little conversations. Mm. Also, these conversations are really short. So, you know, I don't know, does that mean that she has the pairs rotate, because you know there's only so many times that they can say, you know, me gustaría también, or something like that. You know, it's very short, punchy conversation. I wouldn't even say it's a conversation, it's like a minimal interaction. So you know, I want to see how she puts that into practice, and I want to see free of practice. I mean, for myself, I'd be like, okay, a large group, that's great, just go around everyone asking each other who wants cake and all that sort of stuff, you know. So it's a missed opportunity when we don't see the freer practice of these, because it's almost like these teachers think that the freer practice part is, there's nothing to really for other teachers to drive and learn from, where it's actually one of the most important points is, you know, how you run your activities.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, also, it's not just that, but as an observer, you always want to see evidence that the students have actually learned something.
Yeah.
And we didn't see that in that segment. Everything could have just been her pulling teeth.
Yeah.
So we want to see the students doing the work. And that's what I meant by it seemed to be actually too teacher-centric, which is weird, isn't it? Because I was expecting that's what I said by, I think, CLL. I thought CLL was going to be like super...
Well, that's student-y. What supposedly one of the disadvantages of this is that the counselor stroke teacher can be too non-directive, and the students often need directions. Yeah. So, you know... Okay,
so I think we're dealing with sort of a pseudo CLL, right? Where she's like a teacher who's using some community language learning, perhaps. But anyway, okay. So the recording, I think it's worth talking about that.
Okay,
that's cool, isn't it? I want to do more with recordings. I've actually just started really doing heavy recording work myself in my classes, and I'm still kind of at the moment. It's almost a little bit. Learning Dutch, learn. Well, it's not really. No, it's not at all.
No.
What it is at the moment is I'm kind of recording the students and giving them a couple of tasks to do with the recording, and sort of being like, "So, how did that work for you?" So I don't really know exactly what I'm doing with recordings yet, but I'm playing around with them in a bit. I've always had it on my mind to play around with them. I've played around with them before. I've done prescribed activities with recordings for lesson plans here and there. I think there's a lot that can be done with them, and I want to sort of work with them more. And I think there's something very beneficial for students to hear themselves speaking, especially another language, even in your own language. It's kind of beneficial because you hear it and you're like, what, that's what I sound like, and then you get used to it, and they tend to have that reaction actually in the other language. Oh my god, it sounds so bad, or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And it's really good because so far the experience I've had is there might be things that I've been saying to students over and over and over and over again, like, you know, oh, you need to start like connecting your speech together and start speaking like, hello, I want to go to the shops, right? Or, you know, you need to, for example, you need to speak a little bit faster. Some people just go silent, and I don't know if they've finished a lot, especially sort of East Asians, you know, they kind of say something and then there's this silence, and I'm like, is another thought coming, or is this the end of the, you know? And you know, the thing is, I'm keep trying to convince them of this. You know, you often feel like that, don't you, as a teacher, that you're constantly trying to convince your students of some issue that they have. You're like, no, this is something that you might want to work on.
Yeah.
And then you show them the recording and they're like, oh yeah, so I noticed that my phrasal pronunciation is not very good, or I noticed that I leave big gaps and there's no, you know. And it's like, really? So that's been a really good use. And the other side of it is that they hear themselves speak and realize that they actually can do it. Oh, I gave a presentation in English, amazing. And I think that's more what these people had because they were sort of beginner learners of Spanish. So they were hearing themselves actually produce sentences in Spanish on the third day of a Spanish course from, I assume, from nothing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's nice. That's kind of similar to, I guess, the experience that, you know, we had with Michelle Thomas and things like that.
Yeah.
I remember certainly when I was doing like audio linguistic stuff, I was amazed that I was able to say like, necesito esto por favor or something, you know. Yeah. And you know, yeah, it is good. But the fact they've got the recording, and it actually, I love the fact that the conversation gets pieced together.
Yeah, I thought that was really smart. I like the way that she did it, you know, where she's they say it in English, she comes in, does a translation, then does the translation again, and very very smartly chunks it. So they don't, she doesn't just get them to repeat that whole sentence. You know, she deftly navigates, okay, this part, podría tener, and then they repeat, and then next part, whatever. And then it kind of all builds together. I thought that was really well done, in a really fast way. I think that's one of the issues that I had with recording and using that in class, is that it felt like it was more of a time sink for me, you know, like a lot of preparation. And that was a really good example of using recordings with not much preparation.
Yeah. It's a good point, especially in a group class, isn't it?
Yeah.
You'd have to have a real big think about how recording takes place. And there's all kinds of issues as well, especially if it's like teenagers recording each other and stuff. You don't know what they're going to get up to.
But it was really effective how she utilized it as well. You know, gets them to listen back to it, imagine it, listen back, board it, go through all the language, listen it to it again. So it gets reused again and again and again. There's got a lot of exposure, and it's all student-produced, authentic material.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I really liked that, and yeah, I think it added more engagement to it, definitely.
So, just going back to the issue about the teacher talk time, I think one of the places where this was highlighted for me actually was that there was a place in the class where she was talking and talking and talking loads. It was around about the time she was putting the conversation pattern together, and then she like, I think she just finished and she stopped, and she suddenly was like expecting them to say stuff or to give her stuff, right? And she just kind of went silent. She was like looking at them, right? And like someone said something and she said, oh yeah, blah 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 blah, and then she did it again. And there was silence for ages, and I felt like the students wanted to say something, but this classroom environment had been established where it was the teacher classroom, you know, and you can kind of feel it.
It did feel like that they were waiting for the teacher to do something, which is counter to what I really thought CLL was.
Well, I think that is actually one of the reasons, one of the rationales for being critical of TTT, is that it creates an environment where the students feel uncomfortable speaking, because it's like, the teacher's the default speaker and the students sit there and listen, right? As per traditional classroom. So that might be a criticism of her rather than the method, but nevertheless,
it's implementation. I think for me with CLL, it has a lot of, you need to be very confident as a teacher to be able to pull it off, almost kind of like in a dogma way, because it is kind of dogma. I can't remember how the pronunciation. You go in with no materials, and that they are created during the class, and you've got to have the wherewithal to pivot and to build on what you are given by the students. And she came in with a plan. And I feel like when you're doing the CLL, you don't go in with a plan. You go in with what do you want to talk about today? And, you know, you come up to a collective agreement of what it is that you want to cover, and they say, well, let's just have conversation and build from there. So it's giving the students a trust to not just be like, I want to talk about this, and it being completely out there and none of the other students want to talk about it. So
yeah, I think that's the other thing that I would like to see, actually, because this was, as you mentioned about the realia, this was very directed with the, here's a cake and it's her birthday. And ooh, you know, it wasn't prescribed. It was, but it was what you might think of as being kind of synthetic or
contrived,
very directed, student produced, but very direct student produced. So that's kind of, it's kind of a shame that we had the cake because I want to see this. Students come in, sit down, and I mean, you could just do nothing, but I think what I'd be quite happy to put a photo on the board or something and be like, right, okay, so what are you going to say about that? Just, you know, and do exactly the same process, but they're talking about that. So you can have four people together. You don't have to have pairs, do you? So you've got the four people having a conversation. They might say, oh, well, his head looks a bit weird. You know, me parece que tiene un pelo muy raro.
Yeah.
Right. Brilliant. You know, that would be, I would be quite excited about that. And then taking the conversation pattern of that and working with that, you know, even just thinking about that is kind of making me think, oh, that's interesting. You know,
well, I would even say no picture. I would just be interested to go in and be like, okay, this is because you've got to imagine that these, so when we teach students, it's not often that we get these random bunch of groups that are like some sort of mind your language classroom where everyone comes from a different walk of life. No, we'll get like summer camps, they're all kids around the same age. We'll get university students. So yeah, they might have different interests, but they're all going to university of the same age, generation. They've got similar approaches to life, similar life situations, things going on. What's important for them to communicate, what they want to talk about in another language. I feel like if you introduce something, you don't let the students really talk about what they want to be able to communicate in a different language. So I'd love to have a class where and do CLL where you just go, what is it you want to communicate and talk about in English? And then let them decide, a couple of minutes, talking your native language, and let me know some themes that you want to talk about, or we could cover them today or cover them later on in the course, whatever you want to do, and get a consensus, a community consensus from them, and then go, all right, well, let's go with this today.
Yeah, I feel like you've been reading about Dogme. Which I guess
I would do that now, but if you asked Neil, you know, like 10 years ago to do something like that, I would be like, but I got nothing prepared. I would shit my pants.
Yeah. It's definitely an advanced style thing to be doing, isn't it? I think you do need experience to do that stuff as well. I think that, when we do get onto Dogme, that's one of the things that people say about it, isn't it? That it is something that needs a certain degree of being a teacher before you can.
I would say this is more difficult than Dogme because you have that added element of having to have a high level of another language to do the translation.
Yeah. Well, that's just a skill, isn't it? I mean, I guess you could say teaching is breaking down into skills as well, but yeah.
Fantastic. Because, you know, like if you were going to do community language learning, you need to know another language. I mean, this, how else are you going to teach this? You could take parts from this, which is what, you know, communicative language teaching did, you know, this idea of lower the effective filter, the idea of trying to get students to produce their own, you know, like a language and communication, but, you know, to do it in its purest form, you need to be fluent in another language.
Yeah. I believe so. Or you have Google Translate at hand.
Yeah, so maybe in the future there will be technology that we can use to aid us, you know, to do community language learning with, you know, some sort of AI translation or something like that. But then again, if technology is at that level where we can do translation in real time and it's pretty accurate, then what's the point in doing CLL anyway, you know?
I don't know, Neil. I think that's a conversation for another day, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
How will translation affect language learning, language teaching, and stuff like that? It seems like opinions very wild on it as well, very wildly on where it's going and what's going to happen, by the way.
Yeah, and, you know, it's... That was one of the problems as well with translation. And I don't think she was Latina. So there might have been other stuff that's missed out. You know, like, you know, she says también and she's like, oh, well, that could be too, also, as well. We don't really know what is culturally more appropriate. You know, because a lot of the times when we talk about, oh, my other half, you know, we say my other half in English, but, you know, in Spanish, what you say, media naranja, you know, like my half an orange. So, you know, like there's these colloquialisms, when it gets more idiomatic, how will translations work? How will that work in community language learning? Because then that starts to go into personality and how you kind of poetry even, and how you express yourself. You know, her translation might not be your translation of how you would put something. Yeah,
but right.
We're digging really, really deep.
Well, it's just an issue with translation in general, isn't it? And languages and flexibility of language.
That's true.
Did you ever hear about the guy? There was a fellow who translated, I don't know if it was War and Peace, or he translated a really long Russian novel, and it's about 150 pages shorter than the original. And he said it's a better version.
Oh, nice. Well, that was the whole problem. That's the whole problem with people talk about with the Bible, because it was originally Hebrew. It got translated into Greek, then into Latin, and then at some point into Arabic, then into German, then into English. And, you know, a slight change in meaning from one of the translations can mean something quite different and can then affect people's entire belief systems.
Totally. Funnily enough, I've been reading a little bit about this recently, and you know, it's really interesting, the going back to the Hebrew stuff, because we have obviously, they kind of try to piece that together by looking at the kind of the Jewish religious texts and the Old Testament, because they actually vary, but you can see lines that have been taken from the same source and things like that, right?
Yeah.
Because they're supposed to be from the same source. And one of the weird things about Hebrew is that it's a language which it doesn't, like it doesn't put all the letters that come out your mouth kind of thing in terms of modern languages.
Yeah.
Like they miss a lot of the sort of, I suppose, vowel sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you know, like they talk about one of the names of God, there's many names of God. And one of the names of God is this YHVH, right? YHVH, which now gets translated as Jehovah, right?
Is it like Yawal?
No, that was the Greek translation.
That was the Greek translation, yeah.
The Greek translation was Yahweh.
Yahweh, right? Yeah, that was it, right.
Yahweh. And they actually said, like, the Greeks actually, that, well, no, they say today that probably the Greek translation is closer to what the original Hebrew was, because they were probably, you know, closer sounding languages than any of our languages today. So it probably was similar to Yahweh, but people say Jehovah. I mean, you know, certainly Jewish people and Christian people tend to think that the name of God is pronounced Jehovah. This is this YHVH.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, there's all kinds of weird stuff like that with it. And like you say, I mean, you start to dissect these things and some of these sentences, you know, they'll say stuff like, be still and know that I am God or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And you think, well, in English, that can be interpreted a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take into the account that it's been translated like 10 times, you're like, okay, hell. But the original sentence might be something like, you know, I feel happy and relaxed today. You know what I mean? It could be anything.
Yeah,
oh God,
yeah.
Like, I feel happy and relaxed today.
Yeah, like, tranquila, you know, like, is being like peaceful, but peace, you know, like means relaxed, right? But it could also mean, you might read it and go, oh, that means peaceful, to be at peace. Mm. But, you know, there's a difference between being at peace and being relaxed or being chill, or and also it's the idiomatic stuff, and what is literal and what is figurative. Like, for example, when I think about the Bible and other kind of these religious texts, that there's always something talking about a great flood, and people always read into, well, what is the meaning behind this? And now it seems to be actually there was at some point a literal flood that took over the world. I don't know if there was someone out there that actually put two of two animals on a big ark, but, you know, it starts to mix of, well, what are we, is it literal? Are they being figurative? Are they being idiomatic? And all these have been translated, include politics in there, include, you know, teacher talk time, where they take their own interpretation and their directive and prescriptive, and you're like, wow. So yeah, one of the things as well, I think, with community language learning, with the translation, it's going to be interesting seeing how it relates to what we're going to also look, I know you mentioned dogma, but we're also going to look at audio lingual method, the army method, and the grammar translation method as well. Ooh. Because they do that, right?
Ooh. I'm getting excited.
You should be excited. It's, yeah. It's, you know, one of the things that we don't often talk about, and we will talk about more when we start looking at ancient methods of teaching language, is...
You mean pre-grammar translation?
Well, you know, grammar translation was basically what it was.
That was the kind of 1900s, wasn't it, grammar translation?
Yeah, but, you know, we don't really know kind of like how they did it in the past. We could kind of get some ideas, you know, like with the way that they taught other things, like, you know, was it Aristotle that was, no, it's Socrates that does the dialogic learning. He was big into that, right? Lots of discussion.
It's Plato, actually.
Was it Plato?
Probably Socrates was as well. Yeah, because we don't actually have any writings of Socrates. They were all burnt in the Alexandria library. Yeah, so they were all burnt, but Plato loved writing dialogues, and the main character was always Socrates. So a lot of the things that we guess about Socrates, we think that Plato is representing his teacher's beliefs in the correct way, basically. So we think that Plato's character of Socrates was like Socrates.
So what the point that I was getting to was that if they, because they would obviously have been learning other languages as well. Well, actually, that's not that obvious, but one of the things would be like, well, what method would they use? That, you know, if Plato is learning another language or teaching another language, he's probably going to be using the method that he thinks works well. So the dialogic learning, the discussion, and that would sound, I feel, an awful lot like community language learning, because there's kind of like a lot of discussion with that, right? There's a lot of, you know, he would maybe feed dialogue to people and, you know, be like, oh, yeah, I'll translate this. This is what people would say. I don't know. I think
that it would probably be very specialist, very specific and very individual. And we probably have the kind of situation we get now where some people discover or customize their own method, which is just brilliant. And other people just go in the wrong direction for years and years and years and don't really realize it. So, you know, we're going to get our Chris, what's that fella called? The guy we interviewed with the beard. He went to China, learned Chinese.
The beard?
You know, Chris, the Chris guy.
Oh, Chris Lonsdale.
Chris Lonsdale.
Yeah. It's the beard. It's the beard. It's like, why focus on the beard?
He had a bit of a beard when we spoke to him, didn't he? So, yeah, it's like Chris. You're going to get the Chris Lonsdales who essentially do it all off their own back and then read the material and realize, oh, there's actually lots of academic rationale for what I'm doing. Whereas in that case, they're not going to have the academic rationale because language learning will be so niche and so specific that it's not widespread enough for it to be studied and understood. And I think people would just do things their own way, really. But obviously, you're right. There will be people who will be able to speak other languages because, you know, when you wade in and destroy the local tribe or whatever and then conquer them and do whatever, then you need to be able to communicate to them. To some extent, they probably just expect them to learn Greek or whatever, but they probably would have some people learning languages. Yeah, so you're right, and it would be interesting, and who knows, and you might be right, maybe it would be sort of dialogic and communicative, and
we don't know. And so we have this series ongoing where we've looked at the kind of classical 1970s methodologies of silent way, suggestopedia, community language learning. So check out the others of that. Go through our playlists on our YouTube channel. And we've got others coming. We're going to look at the ancient methodologies that we just kind of briefly talked about. And eventually, we'll be going more modern. But what basically we need you to do is to, for us to keep doing this, we need you to subscribe. We need you to like and to share. And please leave a comment. What are your thoughts? If you're looking for more information from myself, you can go to teamteacherchina.com. We've got a whole bunch of materials, PowerPoints that you can use instantly in the classroom. We've got a Team Teacher China YouTube channel where we have videos teaching you how to use those materials. Team Teacher English, where we put those materials into a video form for self-study. And Team Teacher Baby, where I take my experience as a teacher and put that into parenting.
And go to youtube.com/professorrich to see some English teaching. You can catch me weekly live streams on Oxford Online English YouTube channel. Oh, and also you can do a YouTube search for POG Space UK and you would get my alpha version of my new gaming channel, which actually just have some trial content on there at the moment. You can email us here at eltunderthecovers@gmail.com if you have anything you'd like to contribute to the show.
Smash that like button, share and subscribe.
And watch 100% of the video and don't click off. Thank you.
Bye.